Hi.
Hi, I just resent the link to you, but I guess you got on.
Yeah, I got
Good.
it.
Okay, good.
I don't know what happened. I must have had to sign in first or something.
No,
Whatever.
it's okay.
Here we are. I'm gonna pull up the I'm gonna just turn out my email. And I'm also gonna just get my files up.
Okay.
Would you like, can you see what I'm doing?
I see you right now, and then
Okay.
once you share the screen,
One
I'll let
second, I'm
you
gonna
know.
share my screen.
Yep. And I'm also going to be live streaming this on Facebook, so we'll have viewers on there as well.
Okay.
And I see your stuff.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to unshare my screen for so that people can, so I can start with me. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so let's go back here. I'm just going to test that. I should, oh, I had, oh, unshare. So how do I stop the, not share? Pause share, right?
I think so, yeah.
And, I see myself. Is it stop shared?
No, it's still sharing.
Oh, stop share. How about that?
There you go. Perfect.
Perfect. Okay. Awesome.
All right. So I'm just going to, like I said earlier, it's about 35 minutes of presentation, and then we'll take Q&A at the end,
Okay.
which I can help moderate either by, keeping tabs on the chat or keeping tabs on the Q&A.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the
Okay,
big
I just turned
stuff.
my video off because I want to just clean off my glasses. No need.
No problem. Yeah, great. Did you happen to push this out to any of your classes or anything like that?
Well, I'm not teaching any classes this
Okay.
term, so no. But I
Okay.
sent some emails to people saying I'm doing this or whatever. So
Perfect.
it happens.
Great.
How's the response been so far?
In general?
Yeah, to these, like,
It's been good.
attendance or
I mean,
whatever.
we've had a range so far. We've, some classes we've had several dozen, and other classes we've had, just a couple dozen. But I think it depends on the time of day and the subject. But because we're
Right.
recording everything and putting everything up online and everything's on Facebook, we're seeing a lot of people referring back to everything too.
Okay. Okay. Great. I actually did send links to my shul a while ago.
Great.
If, I don't know whether that went out or not or whatever. We'll see. Whatever. Okay, let me put my video back on.
I'm actually just going to mute myself here while I finish up a couple of things, but if you need anything, I'm sitting at my computer, so just get my attention.
Okay, no problem.
Thanks.
Dina? Dina?
Yeah.
Hi.
Yep.
Hi. So there are people in the waiting room. Is that what's going on? I'm seeing numbers over there on the corner.
Yeah, people are joining in. We are technically recording right now, but I will trim this all up for when we post the final copy.
That's fine. So how's it going to work in terms of moderation? I should just speak first, like, you know, do a whole thing, and then they'll ask questions?
Exactly. 35 minutes of your presentation, and then at the end, I'll keep tabs on the chat function and the Q&A function. We've also been allowing people to raise their hands virtually, and I've been unmuting them to ask questions audibly.
Perfect. Is there a way if they want to ask a quick question, can they put it through the chat to you?
Yeah, definitely. If you're okay with me interrupting you, I'm happy to. Otherwise,
that's
we can wait till the end. Okay.
That's fine. I might, because I might ask a question. I might ask them to, can I see the chat?
Yeah, you can.
Can they see the chat?
I believe so.
Yeah, you think they can?
I know you can for sure.
Okay. So if I want to ask a question, I say, oh, answer through the chat. That's okay?
Yes, 100%.
Okay. If you have, and I'm going to probably offer the option of, you know, if I say something that it doesn't understand, please, you know, Dina is watching the chat.
I'll be here the entire time.
Okay. Fantastic.
All right. And it's 12:31. So anytime that you want to get started, I know we have people viewing on Facebook and we've got people that are here. So whenever you want to get started.
Okay. I'm going to get started. All right. Good afternoon, everyone, out there. My name is Shalom Holtz, and this is going to be a presentation on the first Babylonian exiles. I'm coming to you live from Teaneck, New Jersey, despite the background, that's to cover up the mess in the house and all that kind of thing. This is just to kind of, at least we won't go without learning anything. This is the Ishtar Gate, built by Nebuchadnezzar II, the famous Nebuchadnezzar, as part of his revamping of Babylon. It is on view, this reconstruction of it is on view in Berlin, actually. My goal for the time we have together is to put a biblical text, Yirmiyahu Perek Haftet, Jeremiah 29, together with some of the more recently discovered documents of Judean exiles in Babylon itself. The title of the talk, The First Babylonian Exiles, is really meant to, first in two different ways. First, chronologically, and that'll be the Tanakh part of it, and then first, from the perspective of the ancient Near East, from the perspective of Mesopotamia, because these are some of the earliest Jews we know about outside of the Tanakh, people who we can actually call Judeans, and we'll see why and why some. And the questions we're going to ask are, first of all, what do the main question and the main takeaway we're going to talk about, or the things that we're going to think about today, how do the Tanakh and the ancient sources, the extra biblical sources, complement each other? What sort of information does the Tanakh give us that the ancient texts don't give us? And what sort of information do the ancient texts give us that the Tanakh does not give us? We can open that up for conversation at the end. The way the format today is not one that I'm used to using, but not just because of the format of delivery, but also I tend not to lecture. That seems to be the best way to handle this, but two buts. If there's anything that requires clarification from anyone out there, please use the chat. I'll be monitoring the chat, as will Dina Burkett from the alumni office. So if there's anything, you know, that you need me to slow down or you need me to clarify, a point of clarification, we'll let Dina adjudicate that situation as it arises. And she'll sort of, you know, let me know, as she just put on the chat. You know, feel free to submit questions here. I'm going to share with you now a text, a handout, effectively, where we're going to start with the Tanakh in Yirmiyahu Perek Kaftet. You have the Hebrew on the left side of the screen and the English on the right side of the screen. The opening psukim describe to us the what we are about to read, starting in verse 4. So from verse 1 to 3, psukim Aleph to Gimel, we have introductory information. So we have a few bits of information. Eile divrei ha-sefer asher shalach Yirmiyah ha-navi mirushalayim el yeter ha-gola ve-el ha-kohanim ve-el ha-nevi'im ve-el kol ha-am asher hegla nevuchadnetzar mirushalayim bavela. These are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent to the elders and the priests and the prophets and the entire nation, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken captive from Jerusalem to Babylon. Acharei tzeit Yechoniah ha-melech v'ha-givira v'ha-sarisim sarei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim v'he-charash v'ha-masger. After Yechoniah the king and the queen mother and all the officers of Judah and Jerusalem and the craftsmen and the smiths had been taken in exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And he sends this letter to the king, in the hands of a messenger who had gone as part of a royal entourage on behalf of King Tzidkiyahu in Jerusalem to Babylon. Why that mission is going from Babylon to from Jerusalem to Babylon is for another time. I'm more interested right now in the situation that our text is addressing. Our text is addressing this is not the final exile, as I mentioned earlier. This is the exile known in traditional literature as Galut Hecharash VeHamasger, the exile of the craftsmen and the smiths. The craftsmen and the smiths, traditionally Chazal interpret that as the Talmidei Chachamim, but we might as well just, from a level of Peshat, on a level of the simple meaning, craftsmen and smiths are probably exiled to shut down any Judean weapons industry. These are the first Judean exiles. They are taken into exile after Nebuchadnezzar deposes Tzidkiyahu's nephew, actually, the king Yehoyachin. And this is the Gola that is remembered. We just read 2 weeks ago, Megillat Esther. This is the Gola which is mentioned in Megillat Esther, Asher Hegla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, with Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. Those of you who might remember it, it's in Ashkenazi tradition, it's chanted to the tune of Megillat Eicha to recognize this. This exile takes place in 597 BC. So that's 597 BC, 11 years before what is considered the final exile that's commemorated on Tisha B'Av and so on. That is the first destruction of the temple in 586 BC, as the date is. We could spend a lot of time talking about the situations in which the Jews find themselves, or the political situation that emerges. Historically, this is probably the first moment in which you actually have two Jewish communities in two vastly different places, separated by a significant distance. To give a sense, right, just to tell you where they are, Babylon is in modern-day Iraq. Jerusalem is in modern-day Jerusalem. And that distance is not insignificant. Today, it's a little bit easier to sit in one place and bomb the other. But back then, estimates are that, an army marching took about 2 weeks or so. So you figure out the distances that way. And what does Yirmiyahu write in his letter to the exiles? He opens with a message from God. Okay, Kamar Hashem Tzvaot Elohei Yisrael L'chol HaGola, and he says he gives the following three verses, verses 5 through 7. Binu vatim v'shevu, build houses and dwell in them. Nit uganot v'ichlu et piryan, plant gardens and eat the fruit. Kichu nashim v'holidu banim uvanot, marry women and have children. Ukhu livnechem nashim, and have your children take wives, and your daughters marry off your daughters as well, and let them have children, sons and daughters, and increase their revusham ve'al timatu, and do not be diminished. Vidyashu et shalom ha'ir asher higleiti etchem shama, and seek the peace of the city that to which I have exiled you. V'yitpalu v'adayel Hashem, and pray unto the Lord for her, for the city. Ki bishloma yiyeh lachem shalom, for through its peace you shall have peace as well. So a surface reading of these few psukim, in other words, when we just look at it, Jeremiah is telling the nation that this is to settle down, right? To be on some level become somewhat, you know, permanently fixed, or you know, at least for the short long term, be permanently establish themselves with some permanence, right? Build houses, plant gardens, have the next generation is going to grow up in Babylon. And it says, accept or pray for Babylon's peace. That's meaning that they should accept this situation on the personal and on the political level. It's on the political level that we enter into a kind of a below the surface reading. And if you continue reading this chapter on your own time, you'll see that there was a, and if you continue reading Sefer Yirmiyahu, you'll see that not everybody agreed with Jeremiah's message. Most, least of all those living in Babylon. That is the community that had just been taken into exile in 597, which is the upper crust of the Judean community, the king, the queen mother, the princes, etc. They were not interested in, they were actually very interested, I should say, in actually going back, in returning. And what Yirmiyahu is saying is now is not the time for that. Now is the time to settle down. We can expand on the political dimensions of this at some other point and what that meant historically, what this speech means historically. This is the text with which many courses in Jewish history or in, you know, the post-biblical Jewish history begin, because it is the moment at which the Jewish life in exile begins. And it signals that on the one hand, life in exile is exile. On the other hand, it's life. And life must go on in exile. The texts we're going to look at in just a minute are, when they were first discovered in the first few texts that we're going to find here, we're going to talk about, were discovered in the 1990s. And very recently, relatively recently, I suppose, within the past 10 years, about 100 and something more were discovered, and there are approximately 400 texts altogether, if I'm not mistaken on the number, roughly 400 or so texts altogether that were discovered over the course of the past 20 years, let's say, that are often brought into dialogue with our passage from Sefer Yirmiyahu. When they were first published, when they were exhibited in museums, the exhibits used our text as a way of framing the materials, the extra biblical materials. And so I like to juxtapose them, and also as a way of kind of incorporating this into the study of Tanakh. So let's look at our first text. We're going to look at two examples here. We'll look at one a little bit closely, and the other one If we have more, if we have some, if time allows, we'll have a little bit more time to look at it. It's a little bit more interesting. So I'm just going to, for my own sake. What you have in front of you is a text. As you can see, it was published in 1999. So it's, you know, not that old, it is quite old, but it is relatively recently rediscovered. It is the original. I don't have a picture, but the original is written in cuneiform, the wedge-shaped script that was used for some 3,000 years throughout Mesopotamia on clay. And it is extremely typical in terms of its formulation, in terms of what it looks like. It's extremely typical of what you would find, you would expect to find from the from Babylon or the area of Babylon in this time period. And you can see the last line. I'm highlighting it now over here. I'm highlighting it now. Okay, there is the date that I've converted the date. The line is here. There's the actual date right there. So it is dated to the 19th of Du'uzu, which is, you'll trust the Assyriologist, that's the same month as Tammuz. Today's Jewish calendar is Tammuz, year one of Darius, king of Babylon, king of the lands, which is the equivalent to July 29, 521 BCE. That's what's been highlighted there in yellow. And this is typical of legal documents in this period. It ends with the date. And if you look, let's look back at if you look right before it over here, what the part that I'm going to highlight now, it is written at a place called Al Yahudu. Okay, with only a little bit of work, you can see the second half of it, right? Yahudu is sounds like Yehuda, biblical Yehuda, and in fact, it is the city of the Jews. Okay, Al is a Babylonian word for city. Al Yahudu, city of the Jews, or city Jew town, some have called it. Okay, it was a location in Iraq. We're not 100% sure of where it is, because these texts were all purchased on the market rather than discovered through scientific excavation. So we don't know where they were originally found. But we have that they come from the region of Iraq, but where exactly is still a little bit of a discussion. But back then, it was known as Al Yahudu. The place where it was written was known as Al Yahudu. And apart from that little designation that it is the city of the Jews, let's look at the names of, well, let's look at what's going on here. Okay, what are they doing in our text? Okay, so take a minute to just read through the text. I'll comment along the way. It is a sale of a steer. Okay, that's my characterization of it. It begins by describing the steer. Right, this is it's 2 years old. It is white with some kind of a mark on its upper backbone, belonging to a woman named Chara, daughter of Talimu. Okay. Fortunately, cuneiform marks the names of people with their gender, masculine or feminine. So you have the little F on top there and the little M on top there are the Assyriologist's way of indicating that the text tells me that a woman is selling this to a man on line 4-7, Neriyama, son of Achiyakam. Okay. So there's our. So the purchaser is one Neriyama, son of Achiyakam. That Yama bit at the end of his name, right? Neriyama is equivalent to what comes out in the Tanakh as Yahu, So his name is Neriyahu, son of Ahiakam. And what did we know about, Neriyam, son of Ahiakam, based on his name? So if we were in a normal class, I would ask you these questions. What can you say? I mean, I'll put it out there and people can put it into the chat if they want. If you're able to, please, tell me what you think. You know, what do we know? Right, good. So somebody out there said, Gabriel Faber said, he's Jewish and he worships God, right? Exactly. He worships the God of Israel. So one assumes, and if we had a classroom, I would ask how many people have names like that. And typically at Yeshiva University, I can usually find one or two with a name like that. There's always a Jonathan out there somewhere. I think you can raise your hand if there is somebody out there. We don't have to do that right here now. If you keep going, I'll ask the chat, if you can, in the next lines, if you can find the names of other people who probably share Neriyama's religious affiliation. So if we can put down, if you're on the chat, take a minute now or 30 seconds and identify other names that look in some way indicate that they are Jewish. Okay, I see Yehuda Greenfield. Hello, Yehuda. He says Yahu Azari, Abdu Yahu. Good, okay, right. Yahu Azari. You've got a Nahum. That's a good one if you know your Tanakh. It doesn't actually, it's not as in your face as Yahu Azari, but pretty good. I see some others also in line, it's line 16 to 20. You have Nadav Yama, okay? Right, exactly. He is his son, it's true, right? So Nahum is the son of Yahu Azari. So it's a pretty good guess that he is indeed one of those. But then now we're getting into the historical question, right? Abdu Yahu is like Ovadia. It is indeed Yehuda. Thank you. Now, talk to me about the scribe. What do we know about the scribe? Or what can we say about the scribe? He's in line 21. Better yet, what can't we say about the scribe? Probably not Jewish, says Gabriel Faber, right? Yehuda Greenfield also says, doesn't look Jewish. Exactly, right? One of the things that we are learning about these texts as a corpus, as when we look at all of them together, we're noticing that the Al Yehudu materials have all these kinds of situations where the characters who are acting, what we call the protagonists in the legal actions, are all have names with Yahu in them, what we would call Yahuistic names, the theophoric element, an element that relates to the deity, that's theophoric. I'll put it into the text. Theophoric, that's just a word that I would use on the blackboard, but I'm going to use the chat instead. The theophoric element of the name is maybe for the protagonists, it has that God of Israel component in it. The scribes are by and large not with those names. They have names that have Babylonian names, so Babylonian gods in there. So in the case of our scribe in line 21, Anu is the god. Is one of the main gods of Babylon. And if you look, he is the son of Arad Inin. Inin is the equivalent to the goddess Ishtar. Okay, so our scribe is not the same, does not share the covenant with the actors in this document. And so the question is, how do we interpret the presence of... how do we interpret this text? Not so much as what they're doing. They're buying, someone's buying a cow or a steer, not a cow, a steer from someone else. A woman is selling a steer to somebody else. And the question, I see your comment, Yehuda, I'm going to keep going. So the question that we have open is not so much what they're doing, you know, in this particular transaction, but what are they doing? What does this legal transaction represent? Why would we have a document like this? What would be the point of, what does it tell us about the Jewish community in Al Yahudu that they are writing a document in cuneiform that looks for all intents and purposes like any other document in cuneiform from this period? And that they are, but you know, that they're preserving their names, they're using Jewish names, but they're writing a cuneiform document, and they have a Babylonian scribe writing for them. So what would you say here? You know, make some, if anybody wants to make some suggestions, you know, this is actually pretty much where the question stands right now in terms of the topic. So, you know, suggestions are welcome. Take a second. Okay, so somebody is writing they're integrating but remaining distinct. Okay, so they are, and the question is, what is the nature? That's true. They are integrating, obviously. They are adapting the legal document, the forms of legal documents, of legal transactions, but they are keeping their names. So let's probe that just a little bit more about in terms of integrating. You know, do they want to do this? What is the nature of this integration? Is it, the question really is, do they want to do this or do they have to do this? And we're not really, really sure. The kind of the initial reading of this was to read this together with Yirmiyahu Perek Haftet and to say, oh, you know, the nation is saying the Jewish population, the local Jewish population is integrated. You know, just like Yirmiyahu says, right? Let's integrate into society. You know, settle down. They've settled down, and they've settled down for quite a while. Another possibility, because the scribes are actually not Judean, is that in fact it's not them embracing the government or the embracing local culture as much as local culture embracing them, and that for whatever reasons the scribe is there to ensure that the document is, you know, up to snuff, right? That you're doing things the way they have to be. And that remains kind of the state of the question right now, is to what extent are they integrating willingly, or are they kind of, you know, some people use the word coercion, not necessarily in the sense of someone is standing there and saying, you know, you must conduct your business in cuneiform, you know, or with a gun to their head, or whatever the equivalent would have been, but more this in the sense of there was no other way to do this and have it recognized other than to do it this way. The late Professor Yaakov Ellman actually, in discussing these texts, pointed out that when one looks at even modern Jewish, you know, contemporary today, Jewish legal transactions, the wedding document is the one exception that doesn't look like anybody else's, right? The mortgage, other things like that. If you kind of pulled out your legal documents at home, most of them would be in English, and you would know because of your names. But other than that, they look like anything else. So that might be what's happening here. For another minute or two before we have about seven more minutes on the before we take discussion. You have one of the most fascinating documents is the one that I'm going to share now. It's a little bit longer, and I'm not sure how best to... let's start by looking at showing you that it comes from Al Yahudu. It comes from Al Yahudu, so you see that over here in lines 38 to 40. Yeah, I'm highlighting them now. It was written in year 5 of Cyrus, so it's a little bit older than the document we read earlier. We don't have an actual date because the date is broken. You have, if we go up a little bit, now we can look at the actual document. It is a fascinating document for a number of reasons. Again, this is from published in 2006. It was one of the earlier documents that was one of the, again, another one of the documents that was first released as things became available. Now, I just to make sure that I don't forget, the current edition of all the texts that are currently published was published in 2014. The the book that you can find it over here. I'm just sort of putting my cursor around it now. Pearson Wunsch, Documents of the Judean Exiles and West Semites in Babylonia, published in 2014. If you look at the witnesses in lines 28 to 36, and we can, I'm not going to open up the chat just to be sure that we don't run out of time. You see that you've got our, some of our, you know, recognizable Judeans here. You have a guy named Shilim Yama. I'm highlighting his name now. You have his father, Nadav Yama, right? You have the next one down is Irim Yama. That's probably, you know, someone who shares the name of the prophet Yirmiyahu. It's not our Yirmiyahu. Son of Padaya, likely. Natan Yama, right? Tell the prime minister. Son of Baruch Yama, okay? Tzidki Yama, son of Natin. Okay, so we have these, and then you have Atzili Yama and Pilili Yama. And you've got a whole, most of the witnesses to this document, right, are Judeans residing probably at Al-Yahudu, okay? And what are they witnessing to? So it is a marriage, and it is, interestingly, the way it begins is very similar to the ketubah that is used in Jewish weddings today. This is written in Babylonian, that ours is written in Aramaic. But the way it begins is what we call a dialogue, where you have someone saying something to someone else. And in our case, you have the groom, Nabu Bani Achi, son of Kinaya, voluntarily spoke to Dibi, daughter of Dana, thus, give me Nanaya Kanata, your daughter, for wifehood. Let her be my wife. Okay? And then it's followed by Dibi, who is the addressee in the first part of the text, in lines 1 to 7, heard Nabu Bani Achi, and gave Nanaya Kanata, her daughter, for the virgin, for wifehood. Okay? And it goes on to talk about divorce, and it stipulates all kinds of things. And it even has a curse against, which is fairly unique in marriage documents from this period. It has this curse by Marduk, who is the god of Babylon, and Zarpanitu. The editor of this text, Kathleen Abraham, pointed out that when we look at this marriage document, we notice that it is not quite similar to most regular situations in which because the addressee in this text, the person giving the bride away, as it were, is not her father, but rather a woman, Dibi, right? Marked very clearly as a woman. She's got the little F, what comes out in the transcription as little F there, right? Dibi, daughter of Dana. And this is without much doubt at all, an indicator that this daughter, the woman being married, Nanaya Kanata, has no father. Now, at this point, you can kind of let your imagination go and see, you know, you can imagine any number of situations. The tamest of them all is that her father is gone, right, is dead. And from there, you can spin this out even further. What's interesting in terms of, you know, what are the Jews doing? Well, the Jews, the male Jews are all witnessing this. The female characters don't have immediately recognizable Jewish names, but because they are, you have, because Dibi's name is not with any deities attached to it, and it kind of looks a little bit like an Aramaic name, and her son is mentioned in line 41, or a brother of the bride, whether that's the same mother as the bride herself or not is interesting, but line 41, you have a character named Mishalam, again, likely to be, though not as identifiable as Shilim Yama, for example, or Pilil Yama, again, likely to be a Judean. All of this says, suggests that what we have here is actually a situation in which, in which the daughter, Nanaya Kanata, is marrying someone with a very clearly non-Judean name, Nabu Bani Achi. Now, in the chat, I noticed someone pointed out that, this could just simply indicate assimilation on the part of the groom. Entirely possible, right? That you have, and the chat mentioned, I'm trying to find the chat again, but the chat mentioned that they could be, like Mordechai and Esther in the Bible. They have these Judean characters with non-Judean names. Could also be that we have something a little bit, more exciting, if you will, from a Tarian's perspective, which you have a non-Judean marrying a Judean. All that is out there as possibilities. So what we've done here today is we've examined the biblical text on the one hand, together with the kind of material evidence on some level, the textual material evidence for Judeans living in Babylon in the years immediately following the exile. We learned that we learned that Yirmiyahu advises settling down, and we see from just a few years afterwards, not more than a generation, that we see them actually having settled down here and conducting business as their neighbors, the Babylonians, were doing pretty much the same way. Now, for thought, if you want, we can take it up in the discussion. What kinds of stories do these different texts tell? That is, what does each legal transaction tell us in terms of what Judeans are doing? And more broadly, the different kinds of texts, the biblical text on the one hand, and the Mesopotamian text on the other, how do they complement each other in terms of the story that they tell us about Judeans living in exile? So Dina, at this point, we can open it up for conversation, I suppose.
Sure. If anybody has any answers or anything that they'd like to add, please raise your hands in the chat and I will unmute your microphone.
Okay, so I'm seeing a tech question from Gabriel Faber. Are there any Jewish scribes found in later documents? Not so far as I can tell, as I recall. I think the current agreement is that we don't see them. But I don't have the full command of every single text. And if I were to say absolutely not, I'd probably, tomorrow someone will come out with another one. So in this field, we never, we rarely talk about absolutes.
Everyone should feel free to continue asking questions either in the chat or in the Q&A, or you can raise your hands and I will unmute your microphone.
So starting with the question, how do we know that the marriage document was Jewish? Let's start taking a step back and ask the question, what does Jewish marriage look like in the, in the 6th century BC? This is well before anything rabbinic is even on the horizon. So let's start with that. If we go back to the document itself, and I can put it back up for a minute, the best indicator of that is that there are all these Judean witnesses in lines 28 to 36 who are participating who are witnessing this Babylonian marriage, right? Which suggests that this is a marriage of that is in some way affecting the Jewish community And as I said, the woman being married and, well, the mother of the woman being married has a name that doesn't look terribly Babylonian. So we suggest that it is. Again, this is the land of, you know, the land of maybes. It might have been. It's not as though it hardly conforms to what we would imagine a Jewish marriage would look like today. But that's, you know, that's, it's important to distinguish between that, because, you know, the whole idea of Jewish marriage is a long way off in terms of that. Now, Gabriel Faber, who's also here, was there any religious prohibition for a non-Babylonian to learn cuneiform? No, I don't think there was any such prohibition. It was, it certainly was not a widespread craft. Scribes were professional, so that, you know, just like any other profession, you had to learn. That's writing, yeah? Reading cuneiform would have been slightly more accessible than writing, probably, although you probably learned to read and write, you know, probably the same time. But, you know, probably there were people who could read it and couldn't write it. But I don't know of any religious ban in quite the way that, you know, there was a ban on, today there might be a ban on something. You know, that we would imagine, you know, in this, let's imagine, you know, the way there was a ban on non-priests serving in the Mikdash, right, in the Tanakh. I don't think that there was a similar ban on learning cuneiform, although it probably, the access to it was probably not as direct as it might be, as writing and reading might be today. Okay. Okay, so if there are no more questions?
If you have any more questions, please type them here or raise your hand. Otherwise, Dr. Holtz, maybe we can make your email address available after the webinar so that if you...
Yeah, sure.
People have questions that they'd like to ask one-on-one, they can submit them to you.
Totally fine. You have my email, right?
I have your email, and I'll share it with everybody on the webinar.
Perfect. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone.